Bruce Jenkins of the Chronicle joins us. Bruce, how are you?
Hey, Barney, how are you, man? Good, I'm doing good.
Yeah, good, and a happy Mother's Day weekend to you and to Martha and Molly and everybody else. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Molly's going to make Martha a special breakfast in the morning. We got a nice evening planned. And, you know, it's great to have our daughter home. You know, she's a junior at Oregon, and, of course, she would rather be there. You know, she's immersed in that school and the sports and loves it completely, and it's shut down. But she's really adjusting well to being back home. We get along with her great, so it's been a real blessing to have her.
Boy, we've been doing this a number of years. I'm reminiscing and about the Mother's Day breakfast. You've mentioned this many times. The Mother's Day breakfast is a staple in the Jenkins
home. Well, Marty,
it's
kind of a tradition around the house. You know, it really is. You know, it's French toast and bacon and scrambled eggs. I'll pour a little Bloody Mary and I'm on my way, you know?
Yeah, we've been doing this a while. Yeah,
I really have.
It came back to me when you said that. But Mother's Day in baseball is always interesting. You know, in my own personal life, I took my mother to a game in Ebbets Field in May in 1956, and Carl Erskine no-hit the Giants. Believe it or not. I saw that. But yesterday was the anniversary of Catfish Hunter's perfect game. And then tomorrow, Mother's Day, is the anniversary of Dallas Braden's perfect game. And in the middle of all that, we got Matt Cain. So how about the Bay Area with three perfect games? How about those three?
Yeah, that's wild. And, you know, you can't really get, I'd say, any different than those three guys. I mean, Braden was, you know, a bit of a wild man, and he comes out and admits that he was hungover, which is not his custom, you know, the night before a game. But he got a little loose that night and a little hungover. He throws a perfecto. You know, Matt Cain was like the ultimate pro, and you always expected a gem from him, and he was just, you know, so consistent and so great. And Dave Stewart was a guy who, you know, came up with the Dodgers and really, really struggled, had some problems in his personal life, really was basically out of the game, really, until the A's and Tony La Russa took a chance on him in 86 and develops into like the most badass pitcher you've ever seen, just out-dueling Roger Clemens at every turn. And, you know, the guy, if you said you're pitching, we're going to have a guy pitching for your life, who do you want? I've had people say Dave Stewart. You know, so it's just great. I mean, not only the fact that they did it on Mother's Day, but it just kind of covers the spectrum of personality.
Well, I love Stu's no-hitter because it was the same night as Valenzuela. And I remember watching Valenzuela. Well, Stu no-hit Toronto. I remember Dave Henderson always saying that he caught the last out, and he cut in front of Ricky Henderson so he could be on TV. And catch, Dave Henderson was great. I love Dave Henderson. Wasn't he, Bruce?
Yeah, it's like, Ricky, you've had enough pub. I'm going to be on this clip that everyone's going to show for the rest of time.
Exactly. But
heck of a ball player. Had some truly amazing moments in the postseason, so his career does speak for himself. But you mentioned Fernando, and, you know, I always think of the Dodgers and my upbringing down there and my mom, who was not a baseball fan when I grew up. She was a professional singer from Oklahoma, and even though she went to New York and made a name for herself there, she was there when, like, Babe Ruth was playing and Bill Terry and Mel Ott, and didn't have any effect on her at all. But she moves out west, marries my dad. Next thing you know, I'm, you know, 10 years old. The Dodgers are moving west, and we're listening to Vin Scully. And after about a year or two of Vin Scully, she goes, who is that? He's like a poet on the air. And she started listening to him more and more. Next thing you know, she's asking me and my dad about the game. And she learned the game. I don't think she ever went to a game, Marty. She learned the game and loved it strictly through the radio and Vin Scully.
Well, it's true. So many people do that. And, you know, growing up, what I love to do, and you have all your old tapes, the VHS tapes that you got. I don't know, probably 35 years ago, I bought a whole bunch of audio cassettes of games, and now there's no baseball. So at night, I'll put on the Giants' first game ever against the Mets in the Polo Grounds, you know, of June of 1962, and it's Lindsey Nelson and Ralph Kiner and Bob Murphy doing the game. And I'm listening to it, and I'm saying, boy, if I was 10 years old or 8 years old and listening to a game for the first time, you do learn the game from these people because they slowed it down for you. And that's the one thing that there's very few statistics. There are some, but they basically do the word picture, and that's it. So the game, McCovey, his first time up, hits a home run off the facade in right field, right? So you know he crushed it. The next time up, he hits a home run down the left field line.
Oh, my
just,
God.
That just goes over the where Bobby Thompson hit it, where he just goes over the wall. So to
so
your
great.
Point, I think you really learned baseball on the radio.
Yeah, and that goes for me, too. I mean, we started going to the games at the L.A. Coliseum pretty early on, as ridiculous of a baseball field as that was. We're talking about the, you know, where SC plays football and the Rams and everything. And I saw a game in the 1959 World Series there. But, yeah, basically, it was Vin Scully, my dad barbecuing the chicken or the turkey, and basting it out there. And Vin Scully's on the radio piping out to the backyard, and I'm playing wiffle ball with my friends. We still talk about it, you know, and just what a precious time it was.
No, it's great. Hey, talking about parks like that, joining us a little later on the show, Marcos Breton from Sacramento. You know Marcos.
He's a great
wonderful from
yes.
Sacramento Bee.
Absolutely.
And we did a segment on the ballpark in Sacramento, Hughes Stadium. Remember that? In
the Solons?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Was it 2:30 down the line or something?
2:33.
Well, the L.A. Coliseum was known for being a complete joke because they had to build a 50-foot screen, and it was 250, but 233. I mean,
233,
that's just beautiful.
And they built a 40-foot screen, and Bill McNulty hit, like, 55 home runs, and Gorman Thomas, 51, and they had 305 home runs, which made me think, because I think the Twins had 305 home runs, but with a juice baseball.
But
fans loved it. Did you ever get to cover stuff like that in the early 70s?
No, I didn't. I worked the desk at the Chronicle throughout the 70s. I very rarely wrote, and I figured I'd be a desk guy forever. I finally got my break around 77, 78. But no, I all through the A's winning those three titles and a lot of great stuff that happened. I was editing stuff and taking dictation and writing headlines, and I was pretty good at it. I figured, this is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to write. I'm just going to do this. And it's great.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
So where did you get the break? What happened?
I got my break from a guy named Mike Berger, who was a sports editor, and everybody on the staff was like 108 years old, and they'd all been on their beats forever, and I don't mean to demean Bob Stevens, who's one of the greats of all time and is a Hall of Famer and a man I dearly loved, but he was, getting along. You can't cover the game forever, and Mike Berger realized that in the late 70s, and one day he went around to everybody on the desk, all of us young guys, and said, if you could do one thing, what would you do to get unchained from this desk? And I said, I'd just like to be sent to one baseball game. Let me write a sidebar or whatever. And he sent me out there, and then a few more followed, and by the next season I was covering a lot, and then by the season after that I was on the beat. But Mike Berger, I mean, without that, who knows?
Wow, very interesting. Hey, there was a couple of things happened this week, and I'm glad that we have time to acknowledge it. One was the passing of Matt Kehoe. And you were covering the A's in the early 80s, and you know what he meant to that pitching staff, but a great scout as well, and I learned a lot of baseball from him. Your thoughts on Matt Kehoe?
Yeah, that was a real crusher for me, because I covered a lot of games in 1980, which really was his best year. He had a 2.92 ERA and 20 complete games and all that, and then 81, I covered the team start to finish. I never even took any time off. I covered the entire season, and it was Billy Martin, and those guys were in their glory. But Matt Kehoe, I really loved the guy because he was an absolute stylist. He reminded me a lot of Jim Palmer. He was a real stylist on the mound. Beautiful form and textbook and retiring the best hitters. And in the clubhouse, he was just funny as hell and really witty and sarcastic. And I idolized the guy. I just thought, God, this is a big leaguer to me, And, it kind of fell apart after that. After the 82 season, things went bad, and then he got hit by the foul ball in the head in March of 82. He'd been in Japan for 4 years trying to resurrect his career. Now he's 36, and he's pitching, trying to make it back for the Angels, and he's in the dugout at Scottsdale Stadium playing the Giants. First guy in the first inning, John Patterson, just smokes one of those hideous line drives that goes right into the dugout. And I don't think I've ever seen a dugout closer to the plate, especially unprotected, in that stadium at that time. You couldn't even react. It hit him square in the head. He's in the hospital, blood clot surgery, and his agent once said that he never really got over that. And he had tough going in the later years. And you know, the drunk driving and all that. But, you know, I remember the good times. And you know what's funny, Marty? I was looking up the history of his family because Joe Keough, his uncle, and his dad, Marty, were both outfielders in the big leagues. How about this? Marty Keough is playing for the Red Sox in 1960, okay? And Matt's a little kid, but he's probably old enough to know about it, especially later. On that club, Vic Wertz, who hit the ball, Willie Mays got, Bobby Thompson, Ted Williams in his last year, Pumpsy Green, who broke the color barrier with the Red Sox a year earlier, Ray Boone, who started the Boone, you know, dynasty with the sons and the grandsons, and Tracy Stallard, who gave up Roger Maris's 61st homer. I mean, there's a few stories in there.
Wow. Well, Matt Keough told the story about Vic Wertz. Remember that one? Where
I heard your interview. That was great to hear, Matt. Yeah,
we'll play it later on the show, but he's like 4 or 5 years old, and Vic Wertz said, I'm going to give you a haircut like mine, and Vic Wertz was bald. You know, and it scared the kid half to death, and he spent the next 4 hours in the scoreboard hiding until they could find him. Because Vic Wertz said he was going to give him a haircut like that. So, I learned a lot from Matt, and you're right. He had a lot of trouble later on. And Marty Keough still lives down here, and his wife, I think, Sharon. And he just retired recently. He was a scout for the Cardinals for many, many, many years.
Yeah, great baseball man.
Yeah, really enjoyed
And Joe Keough, Marty, Joe Keough, in the very first draft, 65, the A's took Rick Monday. In the second round, they took Joe Keough. And his first season in the bigs was with the A's in 68. It was their first year in Oakland. So just a couple little tidbits for you out there.
Well, and of course, yesterday was the anniversary of Catfish's perfect game at the Coliseum. And there's no real video of it because in those days, the TV stations would, you know, get the first 4 or 5 innings and leave and have to develop it back at the station. So there's no video of the end of the game. There's audio of Monty Moore, but there's no video of it. But I had a chance to interview Jim Pagliarone, who was the catcher for Catfish in that game. And the last at bat was Rich Reese, and it was like a 12-pitch at bat with a ton of foul balls. And Pagliarone said on a 2-2 pitch, he thought it was strike three, and he jumped up, and the umpire called ball three, and he said, oh, God, if I cost this guy a perfect game now. And it turns out that they got Rich Reese to end it for the perfect game for Catfish. And then the next week, Charlie Finley gave Catfish like $500, whatever, for the perfect game, and he wanted to do it on national TV. And Catfish wouldn't go on TV unless Jim Pagliarone came with him. And Catfish gave Pagliarone an engraved watch that that he engraved with the perfect game information on it that Pagliarone kept for the rest of his life. And that was yesterday. That was, what, 52 years ago yesterday. Wow.
It's so great, too, because in those days, you know, guys weren't making – I mean, the really good guys, they might be making $100,000. So, I mean, they're not they're not rolling in money. And it was like little things like that meant a whole lot more than, hey, who's making more than me? I mean, it meant a lot, actually. But, I mean, you know, the gestures like that were the stuff you carried with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's great. Great story. And I've got the Pagliarone interview as well. Maybe if I have time, I'm going to try to play that.
You know what? I think he was on that 1960 Red Sox team also.
Yes, he was. That's right.
Yeah.
That's correct. That is correct.
And, of course, the great Ike DeLock.
Yes, we mentioned him, and we're not going to mention Harry Dorish. We're not going to go there.
No, we try to, but not this week.
Yeah, those are great, great moments. I'm so glad that I took the time to run into these people with the tape recorder. And, you know, and I don't have I'm not the Hall of Fame, but I got a lot of stuff. So when things come up, I'm glad to find them. The other one, Bruce, one of the writers passed away this week, and I met him early in my career when I started in baseball in 96. Was it Edwin Betix or something?
Yeah, Ed Betix. Oh, my goodness.
Tell me about Ed. I remember
him. He's a real legend
very
in the business. Very nice man. I have to say, he was with the Examiner. I was with the Chronicle. And I moved around an awful lot between the Giants and the A's, but I never was part of a traveling crew with Ed Betix. And from all the stories that I've heard, believe me, I really regret it. Now and then, He was a huge drinker, a fabulous writer under any circumstances. a really uncommonly bright guy. I mean, really, he's sort of like, you know, Charlie Pierce from Boston, who's written sports and now politics. Anyway, he's one of these guys who knows a lot about anything, and you're wondering why he's even writing sports. But, you know, real genius quality to him, but totally distinctive writer. And in those days, you're writing for the Examiner. You had time because it was a PM paper, and you could stay up, you know, past midnight with a little Jack Daniels and let her rip. And some of the stuff he came up with was absolutely priceless. I think Steve Kettman told a story about one night after a game, he ran in the hotel bar and ordered four beers just for himself and walked off and said, "Okay, boys, you're on your own."
Yeah, I remember very nice. I remember because I started in 96 is when I first started doing this stuff, and I remember he was around, and I do remember him. I remember him.
Yeah, that's funny because if you're not covering the team, especially if you're with the Giants, you're never where the A's are. And I ran into the guy over the years, you know, a little bit in spring training, and I really regretted that because he wasn't around an awful long time here, but boy, he really left a mark. And for those who were worked with him, he's just like an institution.
Well, there have been some. I mean, look, you're the dean of the writers, and you know that. And Cooperstown should be in your future. I just hope so. But you know,
I think
we've
it's Cooperstown,
had
Indiana.
No, we seriously, we've had people. You know, look at Susan Slusser still doing it, and Henry, and John Shea. Of course, John's book is out this week, and
yeah.
But then I was thinking, you mentioned Kettman and Howard Bryant when I first started.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Murphy was a beautiful
writer. Yeah,
Murphy,
Glenn Schwartz, Ron Bergman, Nick Peters.
Yeah, and the one guy who I got to meet, and, you know, he didn't know me from Adam, and I was just trying to learn how to do this, so it was Frank Blackman. How about him?
Yeah, he was a total character, very very irascible guy,
right?
And could be very contentious, and he'd get into arguments with players and managers and other writers, and I think he almost came to blows with somebody one night in the press box. But
yeah,
you know, a hard-edged New Yorker who did love the game, and sometimes you had to wonder, but his heart was in the right place, so to speak. But yeah, another one of those guys that you never forget.
Yeah, baseball writers are special people. Not to dwell on, you know, years ago, but you know, we still have, you know, they're still great. Look, Peter Schmuck retired, and every time I said his name, I said, "Can I say that, Peter Schmuck?" But from Baltimore, he retired this week. A beautiful baseball writer.
Yeah, I remember when I first met him, I'm going, "What the hell, Peter Schmuck? Really?"
No.
I mean, then you get to know him, and he's like, he carries the name. I don't think it ever really bothered him. You know, he got through his youth with that, so that just, you know, he's got a little thick skin to him. He's a tough guy, and he could fend off whatever came his way. And you know, really good writer. And I remember mostly he was just a really fun good company after the game to throw down a few drinks. But yeah, had a great career. And you know, this is a good time to retire. You know, it really is. I got to say, I'm thinking about it, and it's certainly not tomorrow, maybe within the year or two. But you know, I'm getting along there, and it's things are changing so much. You wonder how much of the game that we love is going to be restored. But and I'm really not going anywhere anytime soon. But for Peter, you know, to retire at a time like this, I think is not bad, because you know you had it. You had it when it was at its very best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, and I still say this, you know, they can fool around with the game and change this and change that and do all the statistics and everything else, but it still comes down to you got to get those last three outs in the ninth inning, and you got to get them. And they're still the toughest outs in baseball, and there's still that drama of the game. And Leonard Coppett told me this years ago. He said, look, the game unfolds slowly. And that's what people love about it. And I still feel that you'll do this forever, because you can describe that drama, and that's what the lure of baseball really is.
Yeah, and I just remember thinking that last postseason, you know, it was a season filled with a lot of consternation, you know, about teams tanking and the replays getting overbearing and the launch angle and nobody's putting the ball in play. And you know, we all had our complaints, but geez, God, when it came down to the big games, I mean, it was just as great as ever. It really was. And And that's you can't take that away from the game. You can't, it's impossible. You can't kill it.
No, that's what I was talking about, Seaver, with the 300th last week. You know, just to watch that game, and you saw Winfield, you described it, the strikeout in the eighth inning, and Dan Pasqua and all that, that you cannot take that away from the game. You can't.
Yeah, I don't know if I think you guys may have been talking about the 1980 Phillies Houston series, or maybe you were going to talk about it, but I did a little research on that because you were talking about it was a best of five series and between the Phillies and Houston. Really a great series, and it was in game four that Bruce Bochy, a late game replacement, got mowed down by Pete Rose, scoring the go ahead run in a crucial moment. And Bochy hung in there and took like a Dick Butkus hit.
Just got Rose. Crushed. And it was a short hop. And,
yes, exactly.
Difficult. He couldn't corral it, and Rose it was an inviting target, and Rose just laid him out.
Yeah, just the fact that he couldn't handle the short hop. Now you're just really dead, and it was point blank. The short hop is like boom, boom. So then they get to game five, and Nolan Ryan's got a 5-2 lead, and he's going into the eighth inning. They nick him around a little bit, and all of a sudden he walked Pete Rose to walk in a run for 5-3. And now it's sort of the moment of truth. And Bill Verdon decides, well, that's it for Nolan Ryan. And and next thing you know, they go to Joe Zambito and then Ken Forsh, who literally had not pitched relief all year. And Phillies tie the game. They wind up winning it. Gary Maddox doubles home run in the 10th. And I'm sure Nolan Ryan was fuming that entire offseason, and perhaps to this day.
Yeah, Bill Verdon. Bill Verdon is not known as one of the great managers. He just was not. He was not. And, you know, it's 5-2. I don't know. It's like look, Grady Little did it with Pedro.
Yeah.
And he left him in, and it cost him the game.
I was there, and I would always defend him for leaving him in. He's Pedro Martinez, for God's sake.
Yeah. Who got the hit? I forget who got the hit. Was it Posada, maybe?
Posada, yeah. Posada. Yeah, double.
Yeah,
but it's that sort of thing. I mean, Verdon, you got to be a little bit of a hard ass to manage. You know, Gene Mauch and John McNamara and Ralph Houk and Marine background and everything else. But you got to get the romance of the game also.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I loved about Bochy, is that he got all that stuff. But sometimes you just got to leave this guy in because he's that guy. And the guy in your bullpen is not that guy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
And, we talked earlier about Dave Righetti as a pitching coach, and that's kind of what Ron Wotus said, that Righetti brought that mentality to the Giants.
Absolutely.
And
speaking of which, here's a guy. How can you be a starter so good you pitched a no-hitter against the Red Sox on the 4th of July and then became like the league leader in saves? It's an amazing career, Dave Righetti.
Yeah, Eckersley and Smoltz.
Yes. There you go. It's not unheard of, but it's really it says a lot about, you know, character and resilience and making an adjustment and beating the odds and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say Firpo Marbury too, but you didn't. Okay. Very good.
It was just a matter of time, Marty.
Very good. Hey, you wrote about Korean baseball. You really wrote a really good column because it was not only Korean baseball, but it was about America and baseball and just how we view life these days. I thought it'd be very nice if you commented on your article.
Well, I set out to watch the Korean games with a lot of enthusiasm. It's going to be on almost every night. I'm sure as hell not getting up at 2:30 to start the game, but there's replays during the day, and I did that for a couple of days, and I realized for all that's good about Korean baseball, and there's a lot, they play smart baseball. They still understand the rally and hitting to the opposite field and moving a guy up and bunting and stealing And they're completely unbridled when they celebrate. The bat flips are like, they're common. I mean, guys will fly out to center. He might have flipped his bat, and it's nothing. The pitchers totally get it. It's been like an art form for as long as anyone can remember. And so, all that's great. But the players who come back from Korea, the American guys, what they talk about the most is the atmosphere there. The fans are literally going nuts. The entire game. Every player has his own chant, his own music. They're dancing, they're singing, they're chanting, they're gesturing in unison. It's like college football, you know, double time here. Just a all-out party. And instead, we're in complete silence, and the fans are all cardboard people.
How about that?
And realistically, Mark, how many of these guys are going to be in the bigs in 3 years? Two?
Yeah.
You know, seriously, I mean, the caliber is good. But I don't know anybody, and the guys that I do know, like, you know, Australian Alcantara, I'm really going to, you know, this is not why I'm watching. I guess you could spend an entire season investing yourself in Korean baseball and really get to know these guys, but I'm just not in. I'm not in. And the lack of the fans is probably the biggest thing, but you have to have some familiarity with what you're seeing. That's what makes it. I mean, you imagine the Giants and the A's taking the field with 18 guys that you literally have never heard of and will never hear of again. I mean, it's just, you've got to have that affinity with the players. And the point I was trying to make is that, you know, with the guy in charge of this country who's set back the recovery process almost deliberately, arrogantly, cruelly, and should be thrown in jail, as opposed to in South Korea, it's like the whole country got behind, we're going to flatten this thing, and then we'll figure everything else out later, okay? We're going to flatten this thing now, and they're down to like 3 cases a day now, just cases, not deaths, cases in that country. And sure enough, they're starting up baseball. They're being careful. There's nobody in the stands. They're wearing masks and everything else, which they want to do here. It's just a whole different thing here. There's so many other things involved. Not everybody's on board by any means, Marty. I mean, can you imagine? There's got to be players who are going, what, you think I'm gonna really leave my family, perhaps, or leave them for a long time and walk into this bubble arena where there's 200 people and think I'm not going to get infected and maybe bring it back home? I mean, there's going to be players, I think, opting out. And so it's an entirely different thing, because it's all about, you know, this is the country where you can express yourself, and that's great. That's why we love it. But it's created an atmosphere where it's far from 100% on board. I mean, you've got counties in Northern California defying Governor Newsom's orders, and, you know, we're so lucky to be living in the Bay Area, because it's great here. And in my area, it's particularly great. I mean, I don't see anybody, you know, who's off the ship on this thing. Everybody's completely on board with the sheltering. You know, we don't have these massive gatherings of people who are, like, intentionally, you know, crowding each other and face-to-face and not wearing masks and calling the whole thing a hoax. We're not in South Korea.
No. Different. Totally different. You really laid it out. So, this is my comment to Ken Rosenthal and everybody else is, you tell me what you're going to do when there's a positive test. Then I'll tell you, you know, where we're going
with all the baseball
stuff. Hey, I don't know if you follow Rich Lieberman and his blog, but he wrote a very, very nice blog about you and I. About our segment, and it was very much appreciated. So it's Rich Lieberman.
I've known Rich for years. I'll have to look that up. That sounds nice.
Yeah, you can Google him, or he's on Facebook. But I know he's one of our ardent listeners on Saturday night. Well, a couple other things, very quickly. There's a good story this week about Charlie Finley, MLB. Someone did it about the mule. Come on, Charlie Finley brought the mule into the ballpark. You know, he had to smuggle the mule into Comiskey Park. You know,
so good.
But
didn't he have sheep in the outfield in Kansas City?
Yeah, they painted sheep in right field, and then they actually put sheep in left
field.
Real
ones.
Yeah, to graze. Yeah, Monty Moore tells that I've interviews with Monty about all that stuff. But he had to. Smuggle the mule into Comiskey Park in a big box, so because they wouldn't let him in. They wouldn't let the mule in those days. But you had to be around Charlie O. the Mule, I mean, you know, right, at the ballpark?
Well, again, I didn't start getting a chance
to
cover
he was
ball.
Gone. That's right, he was gone
for
that, I guess.
I was in the Chronicle office, but I, you know, Ron Bergman was with the Oakland Tribune and absolutely killing it every day on the road, getting one great story after another, because he was a dogged reporter, and a lot of stuff just happened that you know, that fell right into your lap. And we didn't, at times, didn't even have anybody on the road. So we're catching up to Ron Bergman's story every friggin' day, and I'm like the fastest typist in there, so I'm going to get on the horn with Charlie Finley and have him explain or, you know, embellish our day after story. So that was my connection with him, and he got to know me over the phone, and half the time he was totally in the bag.
Yeah.
But just ranting and raving and great. I love the guy. I can understand why his players loved him and hated him because he wouldn't pay him. He wouldn't pay Reggie Jackson, you know, I mean, but a fascinating guy, and far from, I mean, he was a blowhard and he had a lot of ridiculous idea, but meanwhile, three straight world titles, Marty,
mm-hmm.
even being a cheapskate, that is not easy to do.
No, he was his own general manager, too. And
yeah.
he, you know, he would call up the writers and say, "What do you think of this guy or that guy?" You know, that
yeah.
kind of that's what he would do. But
yeah,
quite a story. I heard a lot of him. I don't know if you remember Chester Farrow. Chester was one of the longest tenured employees at the Coliseum and worked the scoreboard. He's not doing well right now. I know he's got a lot of physical issues. But boy, when Charlie would come in town, they would call from the airport and let people know that Charlie was in town, and the organist would start shaking, and you know he would come in and just start firing everybody, and just it was the stories are amazing. But the one about the mule, that one got me, having to to smuggle the mule into the ballpark. He wanted Blue Moon Odom to ride the mule, and Blue Moon said, "My contract doesn't say I'm supposed to ride a mule." You know?
I think he stopped just short of having the mule hit third.
Well, look at all
here
the pictures.
Comes. He's got a bat. Let's see what he can do.
The mule's in every picture. So
yeah.
that was Bay Area. That's Bay Area baseball. It's part of Bay Area baseball.
Absolutely. Boy,
it's really, really something. One last thought. And again, I watch so many of these games during the week. I watched the All-Star game from 1965. And Bruce, I just want to tell you, you know, I looked at the National League pitching. Marichal starts, then Jim Maloney, who actually gave up some runs, then Don Drysdale, then Koufax, then Dick Farrell, then Gibson closed it in the ninth. How about that?
Yeah, and Maloney and Farrell threw like 100 miles an hour. I mean, if you haven't heard of those guys, they were completely lights out. I'm a kid in high school, and I'm trumpeting we didn't have the Angels yet, but, you know, the National League was – National League lit off with Mays, and the American League lit off with Dick McAuliffe, I mean, who was a heck of a player. But Mays leads off with a homer. Then it's Aaron Stargell, Dick Allen, Joe Torre, Banks, Rose, and Wills. I mean, and Clemente and Frank Robinson on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
What a thing.
Yeah.
And Mays leads off with a homer, which to me was topped only by a game earlier. In 1960, they actually played two All-Star games. You can believe that. And in one of them, he led off with a triple, which to me, that was the epitome of National League baseball, because you got to see Mays, maybe the hat flying off, incredible speed, leads off with a triple, and it's like, this game's over.
I remember it. I want to say it was in Kansas City. I could be wrong.
So. I was going to say that. Yeah, I think it was.
But I swear to you, I remember it. So Mark Simon of Sports Info Solutions will join us later in the show, but we were texting back and forth. The 1960s have more National League pitchers in the Hall of Fame than any other decade, and I'm talking about the prime of their careers, not one that just loped over from the 1950s. 15 Hall of Fame pitchers in the National League in the 1960s.
Yeah, boy, it was a really wonderful time to be around and being able to go to games, and I really think I. You know, sometimes people say, geez, I didn't appreciate it as much as I should have. But I wasn't one of those people. I don't think you were either. You know, I'm going to Dodger Stadium and I'm watching Koufax mow down these incredible hitters, or maybe they're lighting up Drysdale or whatever it was. The talent level was so, so amazing. Even the Cubs come in town. They got Banks and Billy Williams. Or the Phillies come in with a rookie named Richie Allen, you know, and just Jim Ray Hart breaks in with the Giants who are already loaded, and it just went on and on like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. So the All-Star, I love watching it, I must tell you.
But absolutely.
For me to say, all right, well, Drysdale's in, you take the sixth inning. Koufax, you take the seventh.
That's truly ridiculous. The American League's going, as if we don't have enough problems, you're bringing Koufax in here?
And the American League is finishing with Eddie Fisher. And not the singer. And not the singer, the knuckleballer. So.
They brought Como after that.
Last week we talked a little bit about John Shea's book, and John will be on with us next week.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
We mentioned Joan Ryan's new book on the intangibles. But
right.
This week, Chris Haft has a book coming out, and it's terrific. From the Stick to the Cove, 6 decades with the San Francisco Giants. It's the Mike Murphy story. And Chris did a great job. It's out by Triumph. And it's just one of those books, Bruce, you'll pick it up and you can hear Murph's voice. I like it a lot.
I tell you, a great thing about Chris Haft is that he's such a low-key, humble guy, a heck of a beat writer, and has been for years and years and years. And you know, I didn't really know he was working on a Murphy book. I mean,
nobody did.
His Murph would never do a book. I mean, we all wanted to do it, right? I remember running it by him one time.
He wouldn't even come on the radio. Come on,
yeah,
I couldn't get him to say
that.
Anything.
Yeah, and so here's Haft, and it's a little bit like Shea. I knew John was working with Mace, but I had no idea the extent of the interviews that he did, and that it was basically all interviews, all fresh, and no matter what you'd learned about him, which is a hell of a lot from all these books and videos and everything else, this was all now all of a sudden he's mm-hmm. talking.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with Haft and Murph. I mean, what a great time for both books to come out, because people have time to really get into those books, and they're highly recommended, and both of them.
Yeah, and I want to have Joan on, too, to talk about her book, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's another tremendous book.
Boy, well, great to have you on. Good news about Original Joe's. North Beach is open, at least for takeout and ordering to go and Mother's Day and all that. So it is the anchor.
We'll pick them up on that.
Yeah, it's the anchor of North Beach. So, so they're open, of course, with Westlake, too, is open as well. But that's good news for takeout and Mother's Day and all that. Well, a pleasure having you on. Check out Rich Lieberman's blog. You're going to really get a kick out of what he wrote.
I will do that.
Yeah, we make Saturday night. What can I tell you?
Thank you, Rich, and thank you, Marty.
All right, have a great weekend. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, thanks, Marty.
All right, okay, thanks, Bruce. Boy, that is Bruce Jenkins. Wow. That is, I start in, about 6:10, it's now a little bit after 8, and I've talked to Bill Lasky, Ron Wotus, and Bruce Jenkins, and that's my baseball fix for the week.